You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. This show brings you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and international parental abductions. With over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field. I will bring you some of the most incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. I'm thrilled to have as my guests today two such talented professionals in Douglas Bowden and Kevin Kinlan. All right. Douglas is the CEO of Bowden Group with 15 years experience and pioneered many of the tools used in the industry today. Kevin works out of their Los Angeles office and is an adolescent therapist working out of Malibu and West Los Angeles, also having been in the industry about 15 years. Douglas, for our listeners, that don't know what an educational consultant is, please share with them what it entails.
Alan, thanks for having us today.
Hey, glad you could be here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Educational consulting is a number of different things for different people. It can be everything from college planning and boarding school placement, and then where the Bowden Group has really, focused our efforts is with interventions for adolescents primarily, but also with a lot of young adults and even children who are at risk for some combination of reasons. They're not thriving, and some plan needs to be developed in order to address those issues.
That's great. Kevin, give us a little bit about what you bring to the table in with Bowden Group.
Well, I think what I bring to the table is being an adolescent therapist is kind of having a background in addiction and being an addiction specialist. A lot of our young kids these days are, you know, studies show that drug use is going down in the schools, but they're asking the students if they're using.
Right.
So, I mean, a New York Times study out just last month has, you know, 98% of teens lie. No big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I bring is kind of a treatment perspective to the educational consulting overview. What do kids need? How do we get them what they need? And how do we kind of clinically match them with where they may need to be placed or what they need to do at home? So that's what I do in the LA office.
Well, and I think that's a great point you bring up about the fact of some of these kids that lie. I mean, it's amazing to me at times when we're taking in a case and as we're gathering the information, we're writing down everything and the parent says, you know, they lie about this, they lie about that, and so on and so forth. And then at some stage, when we then try and ask more questions, they'll say, well, you know, I'm absolutely sure that my child doesn't do drugs because that's one of our questions. Well, I go, now, let me see if I got this straight, okay? You've just told me that your child lies constantly, but you're absolutely sure that they don't do drugs. Can we put this together, please?
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I think that's a great point to bring up. Douglas, one of the things that I noted in knowing you and also in looking at your bio is that you've got expertise in more than one area. What brought you to being an educational consultant?
Well, the truth is that I grew up with it. My mother, Miriam Bowden, was a pioneer in the field starting 30 years ago, and I never expected that I'd go into it myself. And then through a series of career steps and choices, ended up starting a business in her office and realized within a week of that what I really wanted to do was the educational consulting. I saw that there was a great value in helping teens,
mm-hmm.
and that there was a lot more that could be done. I realized that the crisis planning work, dealing with those types of things, really was more where my skill set lay, and I just found an extraordinary passion in being able to design plans on the fly, just having to create them and having the resources to assist people who are in their most desperate moment.
Right, and I think that passion is really important, and I think that's also a blessing that we have. I mean, those of us that are in this industry, part of the blessing is that we get to do something that we enjoy and that we can feel like we're making a contribution. So, and I love it when people go for their passion. So one of the things that I want to touch on, and we sent out information about a week ahead that we were going to have you on. And we have a blog at our particular website, which I'm going to share with everybody. It's answersforthefamily.com. That's answers, the numeral four, thefamily.com. If you have questions either from this or from an upcoming guest, please send us the questions. If you send them to us after the show, we will try to address them and bring them up in the next show. But if you send them ahead of time, we can ask that particular guest. And fortunately, we got some questions, so I want to share some of those as well. And let's see, now I got to find them as I move all of my stuff around. One of them was, one parent sent in one that says, at these programs that you recommend, it says, you know, can I contact or speak with my child whenever I want to, or can my child contact me whenever they want to?
That's a great question. I guess I'm also interested in the motivation behind that question.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that actually, that subject is part of some legislation that's currently traveling around in Washington. First of all, when we talk about these programs, you have to understand we're talking about literally thousands of programs out there.
Exactly.
And so you wonder really what does that mean? So at many programs, there is not contact, at least for some period of time. In therapeutic wilderness programs, for example, letter writing is the primary source of communication, but what's good about that is it slows down the pace, that people don't become reactive over telephone calls. People get to take time, both parents and children responding to each other, get to take time and really thoughtfully think about what's being asked of them. They're able to process questions mm-hmm. more thoroughly than simply getting stuck in the reactive mode of what phone calls often entails. I'm imagining that there's some part of that question that is wondering why kids are not allowed unfettered access to their parents at all times.
Well, and that's kind of what I read into it also, or it's something that the parents were thinking about and they've heard rumors. You know, they've heard things and they go, well, I don't know if this is correct or I don't know if that is correct. And essentially, that's why you get involved with a professional so that they can answer those questions for you. But I think what you're saying is the answer is it's different for different programs.
It is. And I think that there is first of all, a lot of mythology out there. There's a lot of rumors, as we both know. And some of it is accurate, and there's good reasons for a lot of it. You know, the abuse and those types of tactics, of course, need to be abolished. There's certainly some bad actors out there. But in terms of restricted communications, a lot of people would have kids have access to phones to anybody at mm-hmm. all times. Now, is a child who's in a drug treatment program allowed access to their drug dealer?
Right.
Is a girl who's being abused by a 22-year-old boyfriend allowed to contact him? So there's that's a judgment call that each parent gets to make in terms of how they, what their values are in terms of limiting their children's access.
Mm-hmm. Right, and even from a clinical perspective too, you're thinking of a lot of parents have been in crisis management. Anxiety is high. They have to respond almost constantly to this is happening, that's happening, this is happening. So the big T word, trust, coming into play. Okay, who are these programs? They say I don't have to communicate. I don't have to handle anything for a limited amount of time seems like beyond the pale.
Right.
You know, and I think clinically it's a good reason too for a lot of programs to say, take some space, let's see what we can do with the family if everybody breathes.
That's great. Another question, actually we had three that came in prior to the show. Do you conduct background checks on the programs that you refer to?
I don't know what they mean by program background checks, but I can tell you what we do.
Good.
The problem with conducting background checks, let me talk about that, is that there's so many, literally hundreds of programs that we're familiar with that we can't constantly be background checking every item. What we do try to do is keep current with both legislation, accusations, any sort of criminal accusations about programs. But when you talk about what programs are going through attacks on the internet, there's plenty of websites with literally thousands of people logging in complaints about programs, and I can't possibly try to be the monitor of the veracity of some of these claims.
Oh, and I understand, and actually it was all I could do, the investigator in me, to want to sort of answer that a little bit myself.
Right.
When I saw it, and I thought, you know, I could probably touch on some of the things and why that's a pretty broad question, but at the same time, I realize if somebody sent that one in, they want to hear an answer from you, and so I felt I'm going to leave it in its particular context.
But I think that what is the part of background checks that we do that is most valuable to the families is the fact that we've got 15 full-time professional staff, and what we're doing is we're logging tens of thousands of miles a year, probably more than that, every year for years and years, visiting and evaluating programs for efficacy, checking, forming relationships with the people, not financial relationships, obviously, but getting to know the people, look them in the eye, go to the program, sit down with the children, see how they're being taken care of. You can know pretty quickly if kids are being dealt with fairly, honestly, respectfully, compassionately. And we try to do the best. I think we do a phenomenal job as much as we can. We can't possibly do background checks on every individual that every program hires all the time. There's just too many out there.
Right, and I understand. Now, what kind of help do you offer to a family that has worn itself emotionally thin from dealing with a teen in crisis?
Well, there's a variety of different things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the referrals that we get, primarily from professionals, is starting with just giving the family some comfort that there are other options. Typically, when a family gets to us, they've tried and exhausted pretty much every other local resource that they can dig up, and they're starting to want to understand what the next step options are. Therapeutic boarding schools and clinical boarding schools and residential treatment. And
right. So when you say professionals, these are a lot of local therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists that's saying, we've tried to work this situation out in the home,
right,
and it's just not working.
And so what they want, exactly, and what they want the family to start to understand from an outside objective professional source is what the next step of options looks like. Because there are these myths out there. There's a lot of rumors. There's a lot of scare tactics. And there's a lot of sales tactics out there. And so what these professionals want is for their family to start understanding, the family that they're working with, to start understanding the next range of options, not simply get on the internet and cross your fingers and hope you get lucky, but to really have a well-established plan based on good, solid, reliable information. And sometimes that information can empower a family to take better advantage of local resources. Sometimes therapists want to be able to introduce to the child and the family the existence of what we call Plan B. Where mm-hmm. do things go if you can't take better advantage of local resources? Not in a threatening way, but as a way of providing information, matter-of-fact information, that parents will make a choice that we're going to keep you safe if you can't keep yourself safe.
Right, and what that sounds like to me is that you're having to help the parents establish structure that maybe they haven't established up to this point.
I think that what families often do by the time they get to us is they've hurled threats.
Yeah.
Get it out. They've hurled a lot of threats.
Right.
They've lost credibility with the child because, as all parents do, we're inconsistent,
right,
and
right,
we don't follow through. And we threaten things we don't really know what it really means. So the first layer of helping those families who are at the end of their rope, in my view, is educating them. Simply giving them good, reliable information about what they can do. And by getting ahead of the curve, by not having to simply be reactive to every time Johnny or Janie runs away at night to a hotel or a boyfriend or...
Fill in the blank.
That we can now start establishing what will we be doing as a decision-making team in response to these types of things. And how do we give that child information about what we will be doing to give them the respect of knowing that, look, there are decisions that will be made. But I think that just at that very first level of education, families start to feel more empowered to take bolder steps in the home. You know, if we can work to keep a child in the home, that's a success, right?
Right, absolutely. And then, and actually, as you were saying that, it reminded me, I mean, how do you deal with the parent that really is feeling ashamed of even having to make the call? I mean, there's that part of, you know, they've had a professional that's asked them, and Kevin's smiling, so maybe we want to give this one to him.
No, I was thinking that same thing, which
right,
is to peel back the kind of the family secrets, the shame. Somebody wants to buy a house, they'll find a good realtor. They say, I couldn't possibly do this myself. But when it comes to the complexities of family, they say, we had better do this ourselves.
Exactly.
And it's so much more important, you know, to find somebody who's going to be that clinical set of eyes and ears for your family, you know, and that's what I try to tell parents up front is, I know this is extremely difficult to lay all of this out, all of your fears, what are your biggest worries, and then say, can you help us and hold our family? But that's that moment where change begins, real change. And you can help place a student in somewhere that their whole life will be different. I just think it's momentous to be able to include, whether it's a consultant or someone who's knowledgeable in the profession, at those beginning steps.
Yeah, and they need to feel comfortable for asking that, to ask that question. I agree completely. I know that I'm curious as to what you use. One of the things that we use, or that I've used in the past, is that when my kids were younger, you know, and I would sense from that parent that this is a very difficult thing, and that they're not really being that forthcoming with what the true problems are. And I'll say, look, there's nothing magical about what it is that I'm saying or I'm doing. And you could probably have a better chance of getting my 8-year-old to go to bed at 8 o'clock and not keep asking for another glass of water, another glass of milk, rub my back, read me a story, whatever it might be, because they've already learned my buttons. You now have a teenager that already knows your buttons. So just the fact of having a professional involved to work with them, that child doesn't know their buttons. That gives us an advantage, and I think the parent will have, you can sort of feel that sense of relief as it kind of drops down to where they're not having to tie into what they're saying, I'm a failure. And I think that's kind of what it comes down to. Now, from your standpoint, what are some of the things that you're able to do to get those parents to recognize that this isn't saying I'm a failure, this is saying I just need some help?
Well, I think the families, first of all, are comforted by the fact that there is a logical, thoughtful, reasonable process that they can go through. And I think they quickly recognize, too, that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times at the point that they come to you or to me, they've felt very alone. That shame is part of not knowing that there's really...
Okay. And that's a great point. They're not alone when they realize that they're not the only one calling you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We have to put them on hold for a few minutes.
Exactly.
And they know there's someone else with the same problem. So I think that's a big part of it, and I think that the people that we have in our firm are compassionate, caring professionals who, and I think the vast majority of educational consultants out there are, and that we try to reassure them that this is not giving up the parenting role, that if anything, I think that a process like this really demands a lot more.
Sure.
Of the parenting investment, time, energy, emotional energy, and certainly financial.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when a family starts to understand that we approach it, and many of the treatment programs that we therefore like approach this as a family systems issue, that we're caring for all of them, we're not shaming their
right.
parenting, I think they quickly start to get just intuitively that this is about the family getting healthier. They start to see that they are having a role.
Mm-hmm.
Now. That simply having a child in a different physical location doesn't absolve them of responsibility. They're not abdicating their parental rights or responsibilities. They're being asked a lot more in terms of investing in it. And I think that too helps them feel like they don't have to be ashamed. This is something that we can share with other people, and we're going to get better at together as a family.
I totally agree. That helps heal the shame long term too, because we put that roadmap out there, roadmap for health. You are here. Here's the X crisis. Everything seems to be on fire. What would it look like down the road? What would it look like, you know, once, you know, Johnny or Sally is doing their due? If mom, you say that you drink a little too much and that she was upset about that. And dad, you say you're dealing with some anger stuff and you haven't really talked about it outside the family. Let's map it out for you so that you can see, oh, I could be successful. I can let go of this shame because I've got something to point my family toward. And then, especially with Bowden, I really enjoy going from, you know, my therapy background, because I kind of get to case manage.
Right.
You know, and that's what I like about this current consulting position, is I get to look at a family, help them map it out, and then stick with them, you know, beginning, middle, hopefully a happy end.
Right. And it sounds like, and then you have a vast amount of resources that you can use as you case manage, where I think if you're in like a private practice, I mean, you have a more narrow view of what it is you can do.
Much more limited.
Right. And as being part of this group, it's like the sky's the limit.
Well, I know, having been the second employee there to now having 20-something, how much I benefit as a professional from everybody else that exists within our firm. So we have a lot more internal resources to also be familiar with that many more external resources, the programs, the professionals, because we want to work collaboratively with those folks, yourself, any other people that we're working with, and with the programs, and as Kevin is talking about, staying involved, actively advocating for the best interest of that child throughout whatever placement or more likely placements are occurring for the family. I think that also assists when you're talking about this roadmap in that family getting to where they need to be and not simply an isolated series of treatment events. It's actually more of a plan. That's why we use that term so deliberately.
Right, and a continuous plan that they're growing into. Now, when you mentioned going from 2 to 20, I would imagine there's been a lot of changes. What are the trends? What are the changes that this industry has gone through in the last 15 years?
Well, there's two questions embedded in there.
Right.
I think there's both what are the changes for our firm and I think the industry as a whole.
Right.
And I'll focus specifically on educational consulting. First of all, I think one of the great trends is that it's become a lot more professional, that there are clinicians, people with backgrounds in specific expertise and experience in areas that go into treatment. And I think that's a good trend, that it's less and less someone who's approaching consulting as an avocation or because they went through it themselves. And I think while some of those people are quite good, I think that having actual trained professionals is a huge and important trend.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's also grown from the standpoint of being more of a college prep from years ago
right.
now to where special needs, I think, has just exploded as far as growth.
It's absolutely exploded in terms of the number of programs that are out there. It's a growing industry. It's in some cases big business, and I think that the innovation that's occurred in treatment has been a positive thing, and it's that much harder to keep on top of
right.
the good programs and best practices, and that's part of why I think having this many professionals on our team is allowing us to do that. I can certainly tell you that 15 years ago, as a one or two person practice, I didn't know how much I didn't know. I didn't know how good it would be to have a full team around me with that much more knowledge about programs and about treatment and everything from addictions specialists and therapists and psychiatric expertise on our team and educational expertise, special learning needs like that. So the my being able to draw from this extraordinary team has helped me as an individual consultant working with each family too.
Well, share with some of the listeners that maybe aren't as familiar with the industry, what is the type of child, in other words, the type of situation that you're seeing most, where you feel you can be give the greatest amount of help with? In other words, what type of kids are you seeing most?
Well, in our firm, 90-something percent of our kids are special needs. So we deal with very little of the prep school. We do that. Mm-hmm. I think we have good expertise. Miriam is still obviously a very well-known, very confident expert on that score. Frankly, I don't think it's as essential to have a college placement or traditional boarding school placement expert. I think families can get a lot of good information off the internet and make a decision. And you're not talking about life-changing decisions here. It's one boarding school versus another, which I think is important and valuable, but it's not as essential as I believe having a professional guide in the special needs arena. We deal with just about every kind of incident or situation where a child is not thriving. That's everything from developmental issues, PDD spectrum disorders. We deal with addictions, acting out, behavioral problems. We deal with other learning issues, psychiatric disorders. So it's an incredible array. And what we try to do is to staff each case according to the expertise and the particular issues coming in the door. Certainly, the biggest slice of pie, if you will,
right.
is the middle adolescent. The sort of 13 to 17. Behavioral problems, substance issues, out of control behavior, things that are putting themselves in danger.
Right.
And that's where I think it's most crucial, because you and I both know, we all know that there are some tactics out there that are how do I put this? there are tactics out there on the internet, and parents who are desperate also are vulnerable. And so I think, again, you ask where can we be helpful. I think being that objective coach who's gone through this so many times, to think through, do I even want to take this step?
Right.
Because it's a vague concept. When people walk in our door, it's still a fairly vague concept about what it really means. So just putting some definition on that, even if a family says, that's not for us, let's ourselves take better advantage of what's local. Let's ourselves go sure. through this. I think there's value in just understanding what options they're considering.
Right. Well, that leads to one of the questions that came in through our blog, which is a child that has gotten in trouble with the law too far gone, or is there advice and help you can offer, or is there advice and help that you can offer to that particular situation? Again, you know, I know I'm reading it the way it came in right. off the blog, mm-hmm. and when they say in trouble with law, again, it's very broad.
But you know, I think that in some ways that's an easy question. First of all, a lot of the kids that we're dealing with that aren't involved in the law just haven't been caught.
Exactly.
So
that's the truth.
So then we deal with the fact that the kids who's either unlucky or you know, a little bit more brazen in some regards, gets involved with the law. What I can tell you is that our experience is that judges, probation officers, many of whom refer to us, know that a family taking care of this privately with a well-reasoned plan. For someone who's, for those families who are not merely trying to get their child off the hook, but are right. truly seeking guidance in a structured therapeutic setting appropriate to that child's needs, they know that that family's going to have a lot better luck than someone who's just going to take that child in and out of the juvenile justice system.
Right.
And so we deal with a lot of deferred entries of judgment, alternatives to sentencing. There's very few situations where we're not able to construct a plan, present it in conjunction with the attorney
right.
To the PO and the DA, and the judge will typically agree to it.
Right.
And we've been very successful with
right.
that, so not too far gone at all.
Yeah, and I think that's huge, and I have passed on to many parents in which I've said, there I have not run into a judge that does not like the idea, as you said, of a parent that is being proactive. But at the same time, and especially in our economy right now, they love the fact that this is something that's going to be funded by the parents and
right.
not coming out of their budget at a time in which we have government cutting budgets everywhere.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think it's definitely a win-win situation.
No, and I worked for a few years as a criminal justice liaison, and you quickly learned the words, you know, therapeutic jurisprudence, how the legal system can partner with you. But it also goes to the complexity of the kids we're dealing with. I'm doing a presentation down in Santa Ana in October, and so I've been doing a little bit of research. And Partnership for Drug-Free America came out with a survey that last month. And in 1998, kids said they were using drugs or acting out or behavior because peers were doing it. They were bored for fun, kind of those reasons all parents and we all think. Mm-hmm. As of August, what they're reporting, 75%, I'm stressed. I have ADD. I am oppositional defiant. I can't, you know, I've got to take the PSAT, the SAT. And so we're looking at all these kind of cultural markers, stressors. Our kids are under assault. And the situation is complex. The answer needs to be a little bit thorough. So I think that goes, the legal, all of it goes to that whole body of what's happening with kids.
Okay. Well, one of the questions is, I mean, if a child is unwilling or unaware of the school that they're headed to, what are the options for getting them there to that school safely?
That first, there's an assumption there
yes.
that you're going to spring this on a child.
Right.
That assumption is itself a source of a lot of discussion.
Or anxiety.
Well, certainly of anxiety, but it's something that we walk through every family with in going through a decision. If you've identified that you're going to a particular school or program, how does the child get there? With you, mom and dad, and what does that look like? Or are they going to go with professional escorts? And, you know, I think that there's, again, the mythology out there that you've got the hired goons coming in. And I think that was once the case with some disreputable organizations a long time ago. And I think you've obviously been instrumental in helping to professionalize that business as well, that profession. Mm-hmm. And what we see now is that, in a lot of cases, it's the most compassionate way. It's amazing how many times families walk through this level of anxiety around it, but then once we walk it through, once the child actually goes, it's a very smooth process. I think that if we've brought in good professionals to do this, they're doing it as we would want it done for our own children, professionally, compassionately, respectfully. And it's not a goon-like experience at all. I've never seen it go that way. And the kids typically, obviously
yeah.
you know this, but it's certainly my experience with literally thousands of kids that they end up liking the person that they dealt with. We hear from the kids directly. You know, this is where we get our feedback.
Right.
And you talk about evaluation of services. It's from the kids, you know, and they're going to tell us how they're being treated. We're going to hear about that very quickly. So that's a lot of the information that we go by, and we try to convey that to the parents. They never really believe it until they actually do it, and then we get the feedback from them about just how well it went, how good the people were. I think that they're part of that question.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, and I'm glad that you're getting that feedback as well, you know, that it's coming to you that way from the kids. I mean, I get some of the feedback from the parents,
right?
You know, because the parents, I'll talk to them after, say, my people, or if they're doing that particular transport. But when you mentioned the thing about Goon, I couldn't help but smile because, I mean, having done this now for 30 years, and I can recall doing some of these before I had met some of the clients that were referring to me. And then I would meet them at a conference, and they would look at me. And for those that haven't met me or seen me, I'm not an imposing figure.
Well, you're what, 300 pounds?
No.
Thank you for giving that picture to everybody.
Sorry. No.
No, we had four listeners. I think we just lost half of them. But
not
again,
an imposing character.
Yeah, but you know, not being an imposing character. And I had somebody at one time that when they met me and shook my hand, and they said, "It's so nice to meet you. I expected," and they started to pause and they stammered, and I said that my knuckles drug on the ground.
Right.
And they got kind of embarrassed. Well, but yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you're kind of sharing that part, and that the kids are giving feedback to you, because I'm getting it more from the parents'
side. That's interesting. Yeah, you know, we always are asking the question. When we're visiting our kids in programs, on visits home, et cetera, we're always asking the questions about the transports. And if we weren't getting good feedback, we wouldn't be doing it that way. And I think that, as I've come to understand it over the years, I think that what the escorts are tapping into when it's happening is a sense of relief.
Mm-hmm.
That child has been so out of control and has known that things are not working, and he or she isn't in control of himself. They're out of control of the parents. That's the terminology that we use. But they're also out of control of themselves.
Right.
And so there's a huge sense of relief that something's about to change significantly. And that's what I've learned from talking with the kids, is that's how they see it. So that's what I think a good escort is tapping into. The kids are going willingly.
Sure.
They're asking a lot of questions. A good transportation is going to be giving good, reasonable information about what the child is going to be doing, and that the child does not have to be in fear that they're being kidnapped, that they're going into something bad. I also think that one of the tactics that sometimes parents will reflexively resort to is deception.
Right.
And that is far worse, because a child then is dealing with this massive deception. Let's go on a trip to Utah to go skiing, and next thing you know, you're in some treatment program. Mm-hmm. That's far worse.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, there's no approach other than honesty and respect with a child. And it's a very honest answer for a parent to say, "We can't do this ourselves. You're out of our control, not of your own control, and so you are going to be going here."
Right. Kevin, why don't you add a little bit from the therapeutic side of this as to what the kid's going through, and maybe how much further back is that setting that child back in getting the help that they need by starting this out with deception?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I think I'm a huge advocate of escort, because, again, the lack of buttons, as you had said earlier, and, you know, parents are, we're talking about, okay, and where you're fighting constantly and you're going to try to do this trip to ski, and then you're going to drop them at the program. That's never going to work. Therapeutically, I think if we look at it, and we're putting this roadmap out there, and we're asking the parents to go, you know, boom, this is a multi-tiered strategy, and I can't trip out of the gate with them. So those, the first person that appears in front of them and their children has to be somebody, and that's why I am happy that the field of escort has come and you know, as far as it has, because somebody who can be clinically adept and be there with a family in their very first moment of change, here's my son or daughter, you're going to take them out the door. That, for the whole process, can be a make-or-break situation.
Right.
Well,
so,
yeah. And when I've got a, I guess we'd call a horror story from many, many years ago. And we had gotten a call. We were being referred someone to do the transport. And the parents decided not to. And they said, well, what we're going to do, we were going to take a vacation anyway, so we're going to take the motorhome. And we were going to be heading west. They were coming from the East Coast. We're going to be heading west anyway. We'll just head west. And then when we get out to the program, we will go ahead and tell Johnny about it then.
To get out of the motorhome.
Yeah, it's, you know, you're getting out here and we're going on a little further west. Well, we ended up getting a call prior to that because apparently the parents decided they had brought, like, you know, Uncle Bill or somebody that was going to help them. And we got a call saying, how fast can you fly somebody into Denver? We've not made it to Salt Lake City, but we need you to get here right away. This is not working out. How quickly? So fortunately, we were able to get somebody there very, very quickly. And what we found was, and we'll refer to the boy as Johnny, Johnny was duct taped to one of the chairs in the motorhome.
No.
Because Uncle Bill decided that he was going to start bonding with him and telling him that this is all going to be good for you and it's okay. And you know, and they decided that they couldn't just wait and get to where the program was and let him out. They had to start easing him into it. You know, from my standpoint, and I'd be interested in your input, but I mean, the trauma that they caused in setting him back. If he was going, and I believe he was going to a short-term program, and I said, you know, you may have just destroyed what the short-term program can do.
I think generally families are making it up as they go. And this is just one of several areas where it seems reasonable to want to save some dollars. But you're talking about such a huge investment, and I think it's hard, as you're going through this by yourself, to know so many of these details and nuances. This isn't obviously a nuance. You know, duct tape Johnny is not a nuance. but I think we see that in many other ways. Every day we're hearing about families who are perhaps saying something to their child, even if a child's going willingly. Saying something that will ultimately set them up to have lied to their child. For example, you're going here for roughly a month. No, right. No, it's not that. And now you've set up your child to count days instead of deal with the program.
Right.
You've set yourself up to have lied to him when he's there longer. There's any number of these details and nuances that I think we have come to understand just from having done it so many times. And I think a family thinking it, just noodling it through.
Right.
And I don't mean that disrespectfully of the parents. They just don't know, typically. And this is where a good consultant can come in, or someone who knows the industry well.
Well, and especially when there is a better answer, and the answer is it depends on you. You know, put the responsibility on them. It depends on you from the standpoint. The program may be X amount, but if you want to fight it, it can be longer.
Right.
You can put yourself in that situation so that they will hopefully approach it from the standpoint that I want to be part of the solution, not bucking it.
Well, and the families have been making it up typically as they go anyway. So here's the biggest decision, the biggest process, and they still want to sort of go through it themselves. And again, without sounding disrespectful towards the families, I think we have a lot of empathy for what they're going through. It's just that there are certain things that make sense once you do it, once you understand it better, because we have the luxury of having being able to project into several weeks, months, or years into the future how it's going to go. Just because of our position.
Right. Well, and speaking of dealing with the families, I know in this day and age, divorce is a big issue. And how do you mediate between divorced parents today?
Well, sometimes that's very difficult, and it's only done through attorneys.
Unfortunately.
But, you know, and I guess the what we try to do is earn the trust of both parties. But this is something that even in non-divorce situations we want to do. We want to be seen as the outside objective advocate for the needs of the child. And there can be families that have wildly diverging opinions as to what course of action to take, even who are still married. So in a divorce situation, we want to enlist the trust of both parties. That's really important to us, down to fine details about splitting the cost, for example, that we don't want to be perceived even as being in the pocket of one or the other. And I think part of that trust that we earn is also being very transparent, that our goal is to not just create a plan, but to create a robust plan. Right. And that robust plan, the one that's going to be one that both parents can stay committed to throughout the entire plan, is one that is done thoughtfully, planfully, with transparency, that if you've got one parent who's more ready than the other, it often means slowing things down and trying more local things, because I need that parent, the dad or the mom, to remain committed, to know at night or when he's getting that phone call from his child, when they're permitted,
right,
that they're going to be that they're able to say the right things and stay resolute in their decisions and not undermine or inadvertently sabotage
right.
what's happening in the treatment perspective. So again, from a transparent perspective, this strategy is open. We're talking about it, that this is what we need to do. We need to go through one more round of things at home, other local resources for both parents in a divorce or non-divorce situation to feel solidly committed. That's well, very important.
Right. I would think another part of that trust issue is to be able to let, if one parent brought it up, to let the other parent know that you're not buying into anything if one parent's blaming the
right.
other for the situation. I would think
right.
that's huge.
Well, I think even to the point of if we're getting a call from an attorney, for example, we're getting brought into a custody mm-hmm. situation, to let them know that we want to keep the communication's very even-handed, that
right.
there's so often so many buttons in yeah. situations that we know we have to minimize that. And again, there's no secret right. strategy or manipulation here. It's just very transparently, Mr. Jones, I'm not going to see you until I've also planned to meet with your ex-wife, and we've got a schedule that we understand that this is not going to be one side advocating for his or her position over the other. This is going to be focused on the best interest of the child at all times, and we're going to earn your trust that that's how this is going to be played out.
Right. And you bring up another great point. Teens are not the only ones that push buttons.
That's the truth.
Ex-spouses as well.
All right. Well, I mean, how exactly does, you know, does an educational consultant at Bowden Group, what is it that you're doing that's a little different? I mean, what would you say that's different from the other things that maybe other people are doing or that used to be done in the past?
Well, I can tell you that for us, just being a team is different. Mm-hmm. Having that many eyes and ears on our cases is different in terms of how many contacts with programs and how many visits we can do and how much knowledge base we can have and range of experience and expertise. That's one thing that I certainly benefit from, and I think our families benefit from it too. I think they all derive, even if they're primarily working with one or two people, there's a whole team of knowledge behind them. What are we doing differently? I would say that what we've evolved into is much more clinically focused. I think that the industry has gone from, when I first got into it, it was primarily therapy or emotional growth boarding schools, the old CDU model. Which I think has evolved and morphed into more clinical focus from the days when any sort of traditional therapy was completely shunned to now where programs know they have to bring in real trained therapists.
That's right. And I think you also have a lot more niche programs
right.
as well.
Right. That's the innovation.
Right.
That's where you get small programs that are able to really focus on a particular need and to do that well, whether it's a specific learning issues or addiction or the any number of PDD spectrum programs, and different age groups. One of the things that kind of specialization does is it also allows us to place kids with a fairly similar group of kids. One of the great fears that parents come in with is the other children to whom their child's going to be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a legitimate concern, and back in the day, it was a huge pot of kids all coming in with all sorts of different issues, and there's still some programs out there that really claim to be able to do just about anything. And if you're doing everything well, you're really not doing anything that well.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, I think we're a relationship-based model instead of a theory-based model, if you can get what I mean by that, which is anybody, okay, great, they do, cognitive behavioral therapy, they've got this modality. The guy who's doing it looks exactly like Uncle Bill. You don't want Johnny in his group.
Right.
So I think it's really important. We fly all over the United States, meet with the individual, so we don't look at just, okay, here's the great website and the fantastic lawns and look at the horsies. We're going to say, which human being is
right.
the best for this child?
Right. And you bring up a great point about the flying all over, which I'm sure you can imagine, myself having done this for 30 years, we get asked by clients constantly. We can be working a case, a runaway situation, and we find the child and we tell them, you need to talk to someone now because this is the 17th time they've run away. Chances are whatever you're doing at home isn't working. I think you need to talk to a professional. And oftentimes we'll get someone that'll say, well, if you've been doing this for 30 years, you must know all the good programs. Why don't you just tell me about one? Okay. We have an answer that is actually written down, and my staff is trained to know what the right answer is because it's so easy to step into that trap. Or if they say, hey, look, I went on the internet and I saw this program. How about that one? Well, we're now in a position to where I don't want my intake coordinator to say, no, that's not good. But they're also not going to say, well, that's a good program, but. Because before they hear the word but,
it's an endorsement.
It's an endorsement. They've now said okay to the other spouse. I'm going on the internet. I've got it found. And this company said that this is going to be the best one. Now, so what we do is we explain to them that we spend our time conducting our training on locating runaways and how to de-escalate the child and reduce their anxiety and get them to the program chosen by the professional. We do not know your child. Okay, there are lots of really good programs out there. It doesn't mean that your child is the best choice. We also, we do not know the many differences or changes that occur in the programs. And like you're saying, you're going out there, you're flying out to the programs. You are meeting the people. This program might have a new admissions system, or they might have a new clinical therapist that is working on a completely different area. Mm-hmm. And the last time we took somebody there, it might have been last year, and they were doing something different.
Right.
So, what would you add to that answer that not only my company should, but anybody else that's asked
right.
that doesn't understand the system?
Well, I think that there's a perception in treatment generally that this is that our role is a matchmaking function, and that treatment is essentially generic. There's just what's a good program? I get that question
uh-huh.
all the time, and the answer really is it depends.
Mm-hmm.
It's evaluating the needs of that child, the needs of the family. You know, there are certain kids that whose families would not do well in certain systems and programs. That's an important factor, and
right.
and the family can't be objective about itself.
Right.
You know,
or if they're not going to follow up,
right.
why put them in a situation where they'll fail?
Or is there a sibling, you know, that also might need some help that
right.
can do a home-based program in conjunction with the inpatient program, things like
mm-hmm.
that.
And so I think that once we talk about, first of all, it's not a matchmaking service, but the match is very important.
Right.
And that there's a way of even to include thorough educational psychological evaluations. That, you know, we get all the time families that call us up and say, you know, our therapist referred us to such and such program and you. Right. And you know, more often than not, what it is that some other client that we sent to that particular program had a good experience.
It worked, yeah.
And the knowledge that, well, that was a very well thought out, constructed identification of that program, and more importantly, the individual with whom that child is going to be working out there. And this happened very recently, actually, where
mm-hmm.
you know, we got into the case, and the recommendation the therapist had, in a very well intentioned way, made would have been, I think, really destructive for this particular child.
It would have been destructive for Billy. But it worked perfectly for Johnny.
Absolutely.
Right. Right.
Absolutely. And that's where I think we want to talk about our expertise. We don't do transports.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, it would be easy to fall into the assumption that, hey, I can do that part too. No, we do this part well. And I think that's what you're talking about. We train
right.
on these issues. At our firm, we do trainings on things that are relevant to the work that we do. We had an in-service at a company-wide meeting last Friday about mm-hmm. Internet addiction. And gaming addiction, and I complacently thought I knew a lot about it. I know a lot more now. Let me tell you, it was fantastic, and that's the kind of thing that we do on a regular basis on what we do well,
right?
And
that's
to continue to
and that's sort of staying on cutting edge, because the information out there is that these are the things that are coming up. These are the things that are growing. There's becoming more and more addictions to these things,
right?
And I think that's great. You need
right.
to be on top of it,
right?
You know, I glanced over just momentarily, and I can hardly believe it, but we are almost out of time. So before we do that, before I go into any other questions, I want to make sure that we get in. If I could get one of you to read off your website and your phone number, I know that there is going to be more questions for those of you listening. The best way to get those answered is to either call their corporate headquarters or to go to their website, and I'm going to ask Douglas to give those to you.
It's www.thebodengroup.com. That's B-O-D-I-N, thebodengroup.com. And our 800 number is 800-874-2124. I think I have that right. And I also want to say thank you to you, Alan. This is a great service that you've got going. We appreciate being here, and great questions. And
well, you're very welcome, and I love spending the time, and as I've said, even in my introduction for this show, This is a blessing to me. I've been blessed that for 30 years I get to work with some incredible people in this industry. And in fact, I was asked at one of the last Ed Consultant meetings. Somebody had mentioned that I was involved in some other things through investigation. They said, well, if you're not as involved, does that mean you're not going to be coming to the conferences? And I said, I would continue to come for the conferences. I could end up being just a completely different industry, and I would still come because of how I feel when I leave, knowing that no matter what you see in the news, no matter what you read in the paper of what supposedly is negative that's going on in our society, the fact that there are this many incredibly wonderful, caring people in this industry helping our next generation, I would never miss that for the world. And I'm doing my little glance over, and I see that we've only got about 30 seconds. If you can give me a real quick two quick things, what makes a great Ed consultant?
I think passion, professionalism, experience doing educational consulting. There's a lot of people that you know come in from other fields and then just they think they're experts immediately on programs and they're not. So I think having the professionalism is very important, and the objectivity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
All right, we are out of here.
Thanks, Alan.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.